second to pass. Behind the back seat, pressed against the white-stockinged knees of the maids, the Prime Minister crouches under a blanket. A Peugeot and a Fiat are waiting down the street to file in behind the station wagon. All three cars head east out of the city. After they've crossed the Kwango River by ferry boat, the Prime Minister rises from the back seat, stretches his long, narrow frame, and joins his wife, Pauline, and small son, Roland, in a car belonging to the Guinean embassy. It proceeds alone, east, toward Stanleyville, where loyal crowds wait to hail their chief, believing with all their hearts that he'll restore their dreams of a free Congo. But the roads are terrible. The same delicious mud that's salvation to manioc is the Waterloo of an automobile. They inch forward through the night until dawn, when Lumumba's party is halted by a flat tire. He paces on the flattened grass by the ditch, remaining remarkably clean while the driver labors to change the tire. But the effort stirs the black, wet road to a mire, and when he starts up the car again, it won't move. Lumumba kneels in the mud to add the force of his own shoulder to the back bumper. It's no use. They're hopelessly bogged down. They'll have to wait for help. Still exuberant with freedom, they remain confident. Two of Lumumba's former cabinet members are behind them, coming from Leopoldville in another car. But there has been bad luck. Those two men have reached the Kwango River and are gesturing helplessly at an astonished fisherman. They want him to go wake the ferryman. The ferry squats low in the water at the opposite shore, where it left off Lumumba's party the night before. These fugitive dignitaries are both from the Batetela tribe and learned French in mission schools, but have no inkling of how to talk to the Kwango tribesmen who fish the rivers east of Leopoldville. It never mattered before. Prior to independence, hardly anyone gave a thought to the large idea of a geographical Congo. But now, on the morning of November 28th, it means everything. The river is not so wide. They can plainly see the ferry and point to it. But the fisherman stares at these men's city suits, their clean hands, and their mouths, which exaggerate incomprehensible syllables. He can see they're desperate. He offers fish. This is how things go. Lumumba's party waited most of the day until they were found and rescued by a regional commissioner who took them to Bulungu. There they paused, since Lumumba's wife and son were hungry and needed to eat. While he waited in the shade of a tree, brushing dried mud from his trousers, the Prime Minister was recognized by a villager and pulled into what quickly became an excited crowd. He gave an impromptu speech about the unquenchable African thirst for liberty. Somewhere deep in that crowd was a South African mercenary pilot who owned a radio. Very shortly, the CIA station chief knew Lumumba was free. All across the Congo, on invisible radio waves, flew the code words, "The rabbit has escaped." The army recaptured Lumumba less than 50 miles from our village. People flocked to the roads, banging with sticks and fetishes on the hoods of the army convoy that took him away. The event was reported quickly with drums across our province and beyond, and some of our neighbors even ran there on foot to try to help their captured leader. But in the midst of all that thunder, all that news assaulting our ears, we heard not a word. Lumumba was taken to Teesville prison, then flown to Katanga province, and finally beaten so savagely they couldn't return the body to his widow without international embarrassment. Pauline and her children grieved, but having no body to bury properly is a terrible thing for a Congolese family. A body unmourned can't rest. It flies around at night. Pauline went to bed those nights begging her husband not to gnaw with his beak at the living. That's what I believe, anyway. I think she would have pled with him not to steal the souls of those who would take his place. Despite her prayers, the Congo was left in the hands of soulless, empty men. 15 years after it all happened, I sat by my radio in Atlanta listening to Senator Church and the special committee hearings on the Congo. I dug my nails into my palms till I'd pierced my own flesh. Where had I been? Somewhere else entirely? Of the coup in August, I'm sure we'd understood nothing. From the next 5 months of Lumumba's imprisonment, escape, and recapture, I recall, what? The hardships of washing and cooking in a drought. A humiliating event in the church and rising contentions in the village. Ruth May's illness, of course. And a shocking scrap with Leah, who wanted to go hunting with the men. I was occupied so entirely by each day, I felt detached from anything so large as a month or a year. History didn't cross my mind. Now it does. Now I know, whatever your burdens, to hold yourself apart from the lot of more powerful men is an illusion. On that awful day in January 1961, Lumumba paid with a life. And so did I. On the wings of an owl, the fallen Congo came to haunt even our little family. We messengers of goodwill adrift on a sea of mistaken intentions. Strange to say, when it came, I felt as if I'd been waiting for it my whole married life, waiting for that axe to fall so I could walk away with no forgiveness in my heart. Maybe the tragedy began on the day of my wedding, then, or even earlier when I first laid eyes on Nathan at the tent revival. A chance meeting of strangers and the end of the world unfolds. Who can say where it starts? I've spent too many years backing over that muddy road. If only I hadn't let the children out of my sight that morning. If I hadn't let Nathan take us to Kalanga in the first place. If the Baptist hadn't taken upon themselves the religious conversion of the Congolese. What if the Americans and the Belgians before them hadn't tasted blood and money in Africa? If the world of white men had never touched the Congo at all? Oh, it's a fine and useless enterprise trying to fix destiny. That trail leads straight back to the time before we ever lived, and into that deep well it's easy to cast curses like stones on our ancestors. But that's nothing more than cursing ourselves and all that made us. Had I not married a preacher named Nathan Price, my particular children would never have seen the light of this world. I walked through the valley of my fate, is all, and learned to love what I could lose. You can curse the dead or pray for them, but don't expect them to do a thing for you. They're far too interested in watching us to see what in heaven's name we will do next. What We Lost. Kalanga, January 17th, 1961. Leah. You can't just point to the one most terrible thing and wonder why it happened. This has been a whole terrible time, from the beginning of the drought that left so many without food, and then the night of the ants, to now, the worst tragedy of all. Each bad thing causes something worse. As Anatole says, if you look hard enough, you can always see reasons, but you'll go crazy if you think it's all punishment for your sins. I see that plainly when I look at my parents. God doesn't need to punish us. He just grants us a long enough life to punish ourselves. Looking back over the months that led to this day, it seems the collapse of things started in October with the vote in the church. We should have been good sports and lit out of the Congo right then. How could Father not have seen his mistake? The congregation of his very own church interrupted the sermon to hold an election on whether or not to accept Jesus Christ as the personal Savior of Kalanga. It was hot that day, in a season so dry our tongues went to sleep tasting dust and woke up numb. Our favorite swimming holes in the creek, which should have been swirling with fast brown water this time of year, were nothing but dry cradles of white stones. Women had to draw drinking water straight from the river while they clucked their tongues and told stories of women fallen to crocodiles in other dry years, which were never as dry as this one. The manioc fields were flat, dead. Fruit trees barren. Yellow leaves were falling everywhere, littering the ground like a carpet rolled out for the approaching footsteps of the end of time. The great old kapoks and baobabs that shaded our village ached and groaned in their branches. They seemed more like old people than plants. We'd heard rumors of rain in the river valleys west of us, and those tales aroused the deepest thirst you can imagine, the thirst of dying crops and animals. The dead grass on the distant hills was a yellowish red, not orange, but a drier color, orange-white, like the haze in the air. Monkeys gathered in the high bare branches at sunset, whimpering to one another as they searched the sky. Anything living that could abandon its home, some of our neighbors included, had migrated westward in the direction from which we heard drums every night. Tata Kuvadundu cast his bone predictions, and nearly every girl in the village had danced with a chicken held to her head to bring down rain. People did what they could. Church attendance rose and fell. Jesus may have sounded like a helpful sort of God in the beginning, but he was not bearing out. That Sunday morning, Tata Ndu himself sat on the front bench. Tata Ndu rarely darkened the door of the church, so this was clearly a sign, though who could say whether a good or a bad one. He didn't appear to be paying much heed to the sermon. Nobody was, since it didn't have to do with rain. A month earlier, when thunderstorms seemed imminent, Father had counseled his congregation to repent their sins, and the Lord would reward them with rain. But in spite of all this repentance, the rain hadn't come, and now he told us he refused to be party to the superstitions. This morning he was preaching on Bel in the temple from the Apocrypha. Father has always stood firm on the Apocrypha, though most other preachers look down on him for it. They claim those books to be the work of fearmongers who tag them onto the Old Testament just to scare people. Yet Father always says if the Lord can't inspire you to leave off sinning any other way, why then it's his business to scare the dickens out of you. Bel and the Serpent wasn't so frightening as it mainly featured the quick wits of Daniel. This time Daniel was out to prove to the Babylonians that they were worshiping false idols, but even I was having trouble paying attention. Lately I'd rarely felt touched by Father's enthusiasm, and never by God. "Now the Babylonians had an idol they called Bel," he declared, his voice the only clear thing in the haze that hung over us. People fanned themselves. "Every day they bestowed upon the statue of Bel 12 bushels of flour, 40 sheep, and 50 gallons of wine." Anatole translated this, substituting fufu, goats, and palm wine. A few people fanned themselves faster, thinking of all that food going to just one hungry god. But most had dozed off. The people revered the statue of Bel and went every day to worship it. But Daniel worshiped the Lord our Savior. And the king said to him, "Why don't you worship Bel?" "Why," Daniel replied, "I do not revere false idols, but the living God who is chief of all mankind." And the Babylonian said, here my father dropped his voice to a more conversational tone, "Can't you see Bel is a living God? Don't you see how much he eats and drinks every day?" Daniel laughed and told them, "Don't be fooled. That is only a statue made of clay and bronze." Father paused and waited for Anatole to catch up. "I personally like Bel and the temple. It's a good story, but with all the delays for translation, it was going too slowly to hold people's interest. It's a private eye story, really. That's how I'd tell it if it were up to me. Daniel knew very well that the king's high priests were sneaking in at night and taking all that food. So Daniel set up a trick. After everyone left their offerings in the temple, he went in and spread fireplace ashes all over the floor. That night, the priests snuck in as usual through a secret stairway under the altar. But they didn't notice the ashes, so they left their footprints all over the floor of the temple. They were having a big old party every night, compliments of their pal, Bel. But with the ashes on the floor, Daniel caught them red-handed. Father was poised to go on with the story when suddenly Tata Ndu stood right straight up, cutting him off in the middle of hammering home his message. We all stared. Tata Ndu held up his hand and declared in his deep, big man's voice, giving each syllable the exact same size and weight, "Now it is time for the people to have an election." "What?" I said out loud. But Father, who's accustomed to knowing everything before it happens, took this right in stride. He replied patiently, "Well, now, that's good. Elections are a fine and a civilized thing. In America, we hold elections every 4 years to decide on new leaders." He waited while Anatole translated that. Maybe Father was dropping the hint that it was time for the villagers to reconsider the whole proposition of Tata Ndu. Tata Ndu replied with equal patience, "Ah, Yibandu, if you do not mind, Tata Price, we will make our election now. Ici, maintenant." He spoke in a careful combination of languages that was understood by everyone present. This was some kind of joke, I thought. Ordinarily, Tata Ndu had no more use for our style of elections than Anatole did. "With all due respect," my father said, "this is not the time or the place for that kind of business. Why don't you sit down now and announce your plans after I've finished with the sermon? Church is not the place to vote anyone in or out of public office."
"Church is the place for it," said Tata Ndu. "Ici maintenant, we are making a vote for Jesus Christ in the office of personal God, Kelunga Village." Father did not move for several seconds. Tata Ndu looked at him quizzically. "Forgive me, I wonder if I have paralyzed you." Father found his voice at last. "You have not." "Abu, we will begin. Beto, tutakwe kusala." There was a sudden colorful bustle through the church as women in their bright paniers began to move about. I felt a chill run down my spine. This had been planned in advance. The women shook pebbles out of calabash bowls into the folds of their skirts and moved between the benches, firmly placing one pebble into each outstretched hand. This time, women and children were also getting to vote, apparently. Tata Mwanza's father came forward to set up the clay voting bowls in front of the altar. One of the voting bowls was for Jesus, the other was against. The emblems were a cross and a bottle of Nsamba, new palm wine. Anyone ought to know that was not a fair match. Father tried to interrupt the proceedings by loudly explaining that Jesus is exempt from popular elections. But people were excited, having just recently gotten the hang of the democratic process. The citizens of Kalanga were ready to cast their stones. They shuffled up to the altar in single file, just exactly as if they were finally coming forward to be saved. And Father stepped up to meet them, as if he also believed this was the heavenly roll call. But the line of people just divided around him like water around a boulder in the creek and went on ahead to make their votes. The effect of it wasn't very dignified, so Father retreated back to his pulpit made of wired-together palm fronds and raised one hand, intending, I guess, to pronounce the benediction. But the voting was all over with before he could really get a word in sideways. Tata Ndu's assistant chiefs began counting the pebbles right away.
They arranged them in clusters of 5 in a line on the floor, one side matched up against the other for all to see.
"C'est juste," Tata Ndu said while they counted. "We can all see with our own eyes. It was fair."
My father's face was red. "This is blasphemy." He spread his hands wide as if casting out demons only he could see and shouted, "There is nothing fair here."
Tata Ndu turned directly to father and spoke to him in surprisingly careful English, rolling his R's, placing every syllable like a stone in a hand.
"Tata Price, white men have brought us many programs to improve our thinking," he said. "The program of Jesus and the program of elections. You say these things are good. You cannot say now they are not good."
A shouting match broke out in the church, mostly in agreement with Tata Ndu. Almost exactly at the same time, two men yelled, "Kunianga ingeye uyele kutala."
Anatole, who'd sat down in his chair a little distance from the pulpit, leaned over and said quietly to father, "They say you thatched your roof, and now you must not run out of your house if it rains."
Father ignored this parable. "Matters of the spirit are not decided at the marketplace," he shouted sternly.
Anatole translated.
"Abukwe? Where then?" asked Tata Nguza, standing up boldly. In his opinion, he said, a white man who has never even killed a bushbuck for his family was not the expert on which God can protect our village.
When Anatole translated that one, father looked taken aback. "Where we come from, it's hard to see the connection."
Father spoke slowly as if to a half-wit. "Elections are good, and Christianity is good. Both are good." We and his family recognized the danger in his extremely calm speech and the rising color creeping toward his hairline. "You are right. In America, we honor both these traditions, but we make our decisions about them in different houses."
"Then you may do so in America," said Tata Ndu. "I will not say you are unwise, but in Kilanga, we can use the same house for many things."
Father blew up. "Man, you understand nothing. You are applying the logic of children in a display of childish ignorance." He slammed his fist down on the pulpit, which caused all the dried-up palm fronds to shift suddenly sideways and begin falling forward one at a time. Father kicked them angrily out of the way and strode toward Tata Ndu, but stopped a few feet short of his mark. Tata Ndu is much heavier than my father, with very large arms, and at that moment seemed more imposing in general. Father pointed his finger like a gun at Tata Ndu, then swung it around to accuse the whole congregation. "You haven't even learned to run your own pitiful country. Your children are dying of 100 different diseases. You don't have a pot to piss in, and you're presuming you can take or leave the benevolence of our Lord Jesus Christ." If anyone had been near enough to get punched right then, my father would have displayed unchristian behavior. It was hard to believe I'd ever wanted to be near him myself. If I had a prayer left in me, it was that this red-faced man, shaking with rage, would never lay a hand on me again.
Tata Ndu seemed calm and unsurprised by anything that had happened.
"Ah, Tata Price," he said in his deep, sighing voice, "you believe we are Mwana, your children, who knew nothing until you came here."
"Tata Price, I am an old man who learned from other old men. I could tell you the name of the great chief who instructed my father and all the ones before him, but you would have to know how to sit down and listen. There are 122. Since the time of our Munkulu, we have made laws without help from white men."
He turned toward the congregation with the air of a preacher himself. Nobody was snoozing now, either. "Our way was to share a fire until it burned down, i.e., to speak to each other until every person was satisfied. Younger men listened to older men. Now the Belize tell us the vote of a young, careless man counts the same as the vote of an elder."
In the hazy heat, Tata Ndu paused to take off his hat, turn it carefully in his hands, then replace it above the high dome of his forehead. No one breathed.
"White men tell us, vote, Bantu. They tell us you do not all have to agree. Ce n'est pas nécessaire. If two men vote yes and one says no, the matter is finished.
Abu, even a child can see how that will end. It takes 3 stones in the fire to hold up the pot. Take one away, leave the other 2, and what? The pot will spill into the fire."
We all understood Tata Ndu's parable. His glasses and the tall hat did not seem ridiculous. They seemed like the clothes of a chief.
"But that is the white man's law, n'est-ce pas?" he asked. 2 stones are enough. Il nous faut seulement la majorité."
"It's true. That's what we believed. The majority rules. How could we argue?" I looked down at my fist, which still clutched my pebble. I hadn't voted, nor mother either. How could we, with father staring right at us?
The only one of us who'd had the nerve was Ruth May, who marched right up and voted for Jesus so hard her pebble struck the cross and bounced. But I guess we all made our choices, one way or the other. Tata Ndu turned to Father and spoke almost kindly. Jesus is a white man, so he will understand the law of la majorité, Tata Price. Wenda Mbote. Jesus Christ lost 11-56. Rachel. Maybe I shouldn't say so, but it's true. Leah is the cause of all our problems. It goes back to when she and Father commenced World War III at our house. What a crazy mixed-up scene. Leah would rear up and talk back to Father straight to his face, and then, boy, oh boy, the rest of us would duck and cover like you'd have to do whenever they dropped the A-bomb. Leah always had the uppermost respect for Father, but after the hullabaloo in church where they voted Father out, she just plumb stopped being polite. How it started was her declaring she was going hunting with her little bow and arrow. My sister, little Miss the Lord is my shepherd, now thinks she's Robin Hood. I'm surprised she hadn't tried to shoot an apple off my head, if we had an apple, that is. There's not a speck of food anywhere. The ants ate everything people had stored up, which was not much to begin with because of the drought. It clouds up every morning and gets muggy for an hour, but then the sun beats down and dries up everything. Market day looks like you just came out of your fallout shelter after the bomb attack. Nobody there but a few old guys with car parts and knives and cook pots hoping to trade for food. Lots of luck, Charlie. We're only still scraping by with what Miss Fowles gave us off their boat, plus some eggs, because thank goodness Mama Mwanza brought us over 2 laying hens after the ants ate ours up. She lets her chickens just run here, there, and everywhere, so they escaped their fateful death by flapping up into the treetops. I happen to think Axelroot could get us some food, too, if he tried, but he's been making himself scarce for months now, supposedly because he's on some top-secret mission. It's enough to drive you crazy. He said he'd bring me cigarettes and Hershey's chocolate when he came back, and I was very thrilled at the time, I'm sure, but geez, oh man, right now I'd settle for a good old-fashioned loaf of Wonder Bread. Well, the next thing we knew, Tata Ndu announced the whole village has to go on a big hunt, and that will save us. All of us together. It's quite involved. The plan, as Nelson explained it, is they start a fire in a huge circle around the big hill behind the village. That hill is mostly tall dead grass, not jungle, so it would burn up in a flash. The women are supposed to wave palm leaves and chase the flames in toward the middle until all the trapped animals inside get completely nerve-racked and jump out through the fire. That's the cue for the men to shoot them. Kids and old folks get the wonderful job of walking along behind and picking up all God's creatures that got burnt to a crisp. Nelson says every person in the village is to be there, required precipitation. Well, fine. I can go walk through a burnt field and get covered with soot from head to toe. I gave up long ago trying to pass the white glove test. But Leah's little plan is to go with the men right up front and shoot things with her bow and arrow. Her new best friend, Anatole, seems to encourage it. When they held the meeting about it, he kept remarking how she is a very good shot, and if we're dying of hunger, why should we care who shoots the antelope as long as it gets killed? And Nelson jumped right in to agree with Anatole, saying we should be glad for every arrow that shoots straight, even if it comes from a girl. Honestly, Nelson is just proud of being the one that taught her to shoot, and Leah is just primarily a show-off. Tata Ndu and the older men were all against at the meeting, Tata Kuvadundu especially. He sat with his lips pursed until whenever it came around again for his turn to talk. Then he'd stand up in his white wraparound robe and tell whole entire stories about horrid things that happened in the olden days, poison water coming out of the ground, elephants going berserk, etc., whenever people didn't listen to him and insisted on doing things not the normal way. Then they'd all say, "Oh, yeah, I remember." The old men all nodded a lot, sitting up straight with their elbows close to their sides, hands on their laps and feet flat on the ground, a little bit pigeon-toed. The younger men leaned back on their stools with their knees wide apart, taking up all the room they needed, and were quick to yell out what was on their minds. Mostly it was in French and such, but Ada took things down in English in her notebook and held it where I could read it. So for once, she made herself useful as well as a bump on a log. Naturally, Father had his own addenda for the meeting. When he got his one chance to speak, he tried to turn the whole hunt around into a kind of new improved prayer meeting with animal shooting at the end, which nobody listened to because they were all jazzed up about a girl wanting to hunt with a man. I'm sure Father resented his own daughter being such a distraction. It's just lucky for Father he never had any sons. He might have been forced to respect them. In the end, it came down to Tata Ndu, Tata Kuvadundu, and Anatole doing the talking. Tata Ndu, in his orange and white striped cloth wrapped across his chest, he gave the impression, "I am the chief, and don't you forget it." And of course, Tata Kuvadundu is the voodoo witch doctor, and you don't forget that either, what with him having 6 toes and going cross-eyed in the middle of a sentence just for the scary effect. But Anatole is the schoolteacher, after all, and a lot of the boys that now at the ripe age of 19 or so have wives and families formerly learned their 2+2 from him in the first place. They still call him Monsieur Anatole instead of the usual Tata because he was their schoolmaster. So it got to be divided down the lines of young against old, with Anatole persuading a lot of the younger men. And in our village, believe you me, people die for the slightest provocation, so there are not that many old people still hanging around. Leah had to sit in the front of the room all night long without saying a peep. She kept looking at Anatole, but after a while you couldn't tell really if he was on her side. He stopped mentioning what a good shot she was and moved on to the subject of whether you should kill a rat for its skin or kill a rat for being a rat, whatever that may mean. Tata Ndu said if it runs in a rat's skin, it is a rat. Then they all got to yelling about foreigners, the army takeover, and somebody thrown in prison, which, if you ask me, is at least a more favorable subject than rats. At the end, it got turned into another showdown. Were we going to keep talking about this all night or have a vote? Anatole was very against the voting. He said this was a matter to be discussed and agreed on properly, because even if Kalanga ran one white family out of town, there were a million more whites in the world, and if you couldn't learn to tell a good rat from a bad one, you'd soon be living with both in your house. And, he said, don't be surprised when your own daughter or wife wants to shoot a bow and arrow behind your back. Well, everybody laughed at that, but I failed to see the humor. Was he calling us rats? Tata Ndu had had just about enough. He marched up and plunked down two big clay voting bowls in front of Leah. It kind of made people mad when he did it. You could see him siding with Anatole that it needed more talk. But nope, time's up. As for Leah, she looked like a chicken fixing to get thrown in the stew pot. But was I supposed to feel sorry for her? She asked for it, with all her attention-getting mechanisms. Some of the men still seemed to think the whole thing was funny, so maybe they thought she'd shoot an arrow through her foot, for all I know. But when it came time to walk up and cast their votes, 51 stones went in the bowl with Leah's bow and arrow by it, 45 for the one with the cook pot. Man alive, Tatakuvadundu was not one bit happy then. He stood up and hollered that we'd turned over the natural way of things, and boy, would we be sorry. He made a very big point of looking at Anatole when he said that, but he also seemed put out with Tata Ndu for the voting activity, which got backfired on him. Tata Ndu didn't say much, but he frowned so hard his big bald forehead wrinkled up like the bread dough when you punch it down. He held his big muscle man arms across his chest, and even though he was an elderly man of 50 or so, he looked like he could still beat the pants off anybody in the room. "The animals are listening to us tonight," Tatakuvadundu yelled out and kind of started singing with his eyes closed. Then he stopped. It got real quiet, and he looked very slowly around the room. "The leopards will walk upright like men on our paths. The snakes will come out of the ground and seek our houses instead of hiding in their own. Bwe, you did this. You decided the old ways are no good. Don't blame the animals. It was your decision. You want to change everything, and now, Kuleka, do you expect to sleep?" Nobody said a word. They just looked scared. Tata Ndu sat with his head thrown back and his eyes just little slits, watching. "No one will sleep!" Tatakuvadundu suddenly shrieked, leaping up and waving his arms in the air. Everybody else kind of jumped at that, but Leah sat stock still. Like I said, showing off. She didn't even blink. Then we all got up and left, and she followed us out, and no one in our family said boo to each other all the way home. When we got to the door, Father stopped, blocking the way. Oh, brother, we were going to have to stand out there on the porch and hear the moral of the story. "Leah," he said, "who is the master of this house?" She stood with her chin down, not answering. Finally, she said, "You are," in a voice as little as an ant. "I'm sorry, I didn't hear you." "You are!" she screamed at him. Mother and I jumped, but Father merely replied in a normal voice. "What occurred this evening may be of some consequence to the village, but it's of no consequence to you. God has ordained that you honor thy father and submit thyself to the rules of his house." Leah didn't even move. Her chin was still tilted down, but her eyes were straight on him like nobody's business. "So," she said quietly, "you agree with Tata Ndu and the witch doctor?" Father sucked in his breath. "They agree with me. It's nonsense for you to hunt with the man. You're only causing trouble, and I forbid it." Leah slung her bow over her shoulder. "I'm going with the men, and that's final." Marched off the porch, right out into the dead of night, where supposedly the animals were wide awake and walking around like human beings. Mother and Ada and I stood there with our traps hanging open. You could have knocked us over with a feather. Father went crazy. We'd always wondered what would happen if we flat out disobeyed him. Now we were fixing to see. He lit out after her with his wide leather belt already coming out of his pants as he stomped through the dirt. But by the time he got to the edge of the yard, she was gone. She'd vamoosed into the tall grass, and off she was headed for the jungle, where it was plain to see he'd never find her. Leah can climb trees like a chimpanzee when nobody's even chasing her. Instead of coming back, he acted like he'd just decided to stroll out there for the sake of thrashing the trees with his belt, and man alive, he did. We heard him for an hour. We peeked out the window and saw he'd cut down a whole stand of sugar cane by lashing it with his belt. We started to get scared about what he'd do when he finally came in, for there really was no telling. Our doors didn't lock, but Mother came in our room with us and helped us push the beds around so the door was blocked. We went to bed early with metal pot lids and knives and things from the kitchen to protect ourselves with because we couldn't think of anything else. It was like the armor they had in the knights of old. Ruth May put an aluminum saucepan on her head and slid two comic books down the seat of her jeans in case of a whipping. Mother slept in Leah's bed. Or lay there quiet, rather, for really none of us slept a wink. Leah came in the window before dawn and whispered to Mother a while, but I don't think she slept either. Half the village was in the same boat with us, even though I guess for different reasons. After the way Tatakuvadundu carried on at the meeting and gave off the evil eye, nobody could sleep. According to Nelson, that was the one and only topic of conversation. They said their animals were looking at them. People killed the last few they had, goats, chickens, or dogs. You could smell the blood everywhere. They put the animals' heads in front of their houses in calabash bowls to keep away the kibasu, they said. Well, why were they dumb enough to vote for Leah anyway, is what I asked Nelson, if they knew it was going to get Tatakuvadundu so riled up. Nelson said some of them that voted for her were put out with Tata Ndu, and some were put out with Father, so everybody ended up getting what they didn't want and now had to go along with it. Nobody even cares that much one way or another about Leah, is what Nelson said. Oh, well, I told him, that's what we call democracy. Strange to say, at our house the next morning, it was suddenly peace on earth. Father acted like nothing much had happened. He had cuts and poisonwood boils on his arms from all his thrashing in the bushes, but yet he just drank his tea at breakfast without a word and then put some poultice on his arms and went out on the porch to read his Bible. We wondered, is he looking for the world's longest the verse to give Leah on the subject of impudence? Is he looking up what Jesus might have to say about preachers that murder their own daughters? Or maybe he decided he couldn't win this fight, so he was going to pretend it never happened and Leah was beneath his notice. With Father, life's just one surprise after another. Leah did at least have the brains to make herself scarce. She stayed either at Anatole's school or out in the woods having a bow and arrow contest with Nelson to see who could shoot a bug off a branch. That was the kind of thing she usually did. But there was plenty of nervous tension left in our household, believe you me. Ruth May peed in her pants just because Father coughed out on the porch. And guess who had to be the one to get her cleaned up? Me. I did not appreciate what we were being put through all because of Leah. That evening was the night before the hunt, with Leah still keeping her distance. But her pal Anatole found an evil sign outside his hut, so we were told by Nelson. Mother had sent him over to the school to take Leah some boiled eggs for dinner, and he came running back to tell us Anatole was over there looking like he'd seen a ghost. Nelson wouldn't say what the evil sign was, just that it was a dreaded kibatsu sign of a bad curse put on Anatole. We kind of thought he might have made the whole thing up. Nelson could be dramatic. Well, no, sir. Next morning, bright and early, Anatole found a green mamba snake curled up by his cot, and it was just by the grace of God he didn't get bit on the leg and die on the spot. Good luck or a miracle won. They said he usually always gets out of bed before daybreak and goes out for his constitutional and would have stepped right on it. But that morning, for some reason, he woke up too early and decided to light his lamp and read in bed a while before getting up, and that's when he saw it. He thought someone had thrown a rope inside his house for another evil sign, but then it moved. No more signs, this was the true evil thing. The story went buzzing around the village quicker even than if we'd had telephones. People were running around because it was the big day and they had to get ready, but this gave them something extra to think about, and boy, oh boy, they did. I don't care if they were followers of God Almighty or the things that bump you in the night. They were praying to it now, believe you me, thanking their lucky stars that what happened to Anatole hadn't happened to them. Ada. Beto Nki Tutasala means, what are we doing? Doing, we are what? Alas, Atuti, not Eb. Alas. The night before the hunt there was no sleep at all. Eye on sleep, peels no eye. We thought we were looking, but could not see what was before us. Leopards walked upright on the paths, and snakes moved quietly from their holes. The S on the floor was not for sleep. People are Bantu. The singular is Muntu. Muntu does not mean exactly the same as person, though, because it describes a living person, a dead one, or someone not yet born. Muntu persists through all those conditions unchanged. The Bantu speak of self as a vision residing inside, peering out through the eye holes of the body, waiting for whatever happens next. Using the body as a mask, Muntu watches and waits without fear, because Muntu itself cannot die. The transition from spirit to body and back to spirit again is merely a venture. It is a ride on the power of Nomo, the force of a name to call oneself. Nomo rains from a cloud, rises in the vapor from a human mouth, a song, a scream, a prayer. A drum gives Nomo in Congo, where drums have language. A dance gives Nomo, where bodies are not separate from the will that inhabits them. In that other long-ago place, America, I was a failed combination of too weak body and overstrong will. But in Congo, I am those things perfectly united. Ada. The night before the hunt, while no one slept, every Muntu in Kilanga danced and sang. Drums, lips, bodies. In song, they named the animals that would become our feast and salvation in the morning. And they named the things they feared. Snake, hunger, leopards that walk upright on the paths like men. These are the Nomo, they chanted. These bodies living and dancing and joining together with slick, black other bodies, all beating the thing with feathers. Beating out the dear, dear hope, a chance to go on living. But Muntu did not care if the bodies lived or died on the morrow. Muntu peered out through the eye holes, watching closely to see what would happen next. Before first light, we all came together at the edge of the village, not down by the river where our father would have gathered us, but away from there on the side toward the hill where our salvation lay. We made our march into the field of elephant grass, tramped upon the big hill rising. Grass as tall as living men, and taller, but dry and white as a dead woman's hair. With sticks, the men laid the tall grass down. They beat it in unison as if beating down grass were a dance, grunting softly in a low, long rhythm that ran back to us from the head of the file. Men with bows and arrows, men with spears, even a few with guns, were up ahead of us. Their chant was the only sound in the cool morning haze. Children and women followed, carrying the largest baskets their arms were able to circle. Mine hung on a strap over my shoulder because my arms do not circle well. Behind us came the oldest women carrying smoldering torches, greenheart poles wrapped in palm oil-soaked rags. High up they held their torches, bruising the air overhead with the smoke of our procession. The sun hung low on the river, seeming reluctant to enter this strange day. Then it rose redly into the purpled sky, resembling a black eye. At a signal given by Tata Ndu, our single file divided and curved outward to either side of the hill. A solemn wishbone of eager, hungry people, that is how we might have appeared to the Muntu, dead and unborn, who watched from above. In half an hour, the fronts of the two lines met, and we hungry wishbone people of Kilanga completed our circle around the hill. A shout fluttered up. The fire starters laid down their torches. Younger women opened their panniers and ran forward, fanning the flames like moths dancing before a candle. Our circle was so large, the shouts we heard from the other side seemed to come from another country. Soon all sound was swallowed by the fire. It did not roar, but grumbled, cracked, shushed, sucking the air from our throats and all speech with it. The flame rose and licked the grass, and we all moved forward, chasing the line of brightness ahead of us. Chasing flames that passed hungrily over the startled grass, leaving nothing of life behind. Nothing but hot, black, bare ground and delicate white filaments of ash which stirred and crumbled under the trample of bare feet. Now the men rushed ahead with bows cocked, impatient for the circle to shrink toward its center. Smaller and smaller the circle ungrew, with all the former life of a broad, grassy plain trapped inside. The animals all caught up in this dance together, mice and men. Men who pushed and pranced, appearing to us as dark stick puppets before the wall of fire. The old people and children came along slowly behind. We were like odd, ruined flagpoles bent double with our bright clothes flapping. Slow scavengers. We fanned out across the hissing black field, picking up charred insects. Most common were the crisp Nguka caterpillars, favorite snack of Anatole's schoolboys, which resembled small twigs and were impossible to see until I learned to sense their particular gray curve. We picked them up by the basketful until they filled my mind's eye so completely I knew I would see them in my sleep. Easier to find were the dikonko, edible locusts and crickets whose plump abdomens were shrunk translucent like balloons half filled with water. Caterpillars one after another I laid on my tongue, their char, crisp, bristle taste a sweet momentary salve to a body aching for protein. Hunger of the body is altogether different from the shallow daily hunger of the belly. Those who have known this kind of hunger cannot entirely love ever again those who have not. The fire moved faster than we did, we the young and elderly shepherdesses of dead insects. Sometimes I stood up straight to let the blood run from my head to the numb slabs of muscle at the backs of my thighs. Mother held on tight to the hand of Ruth May, her chosen child, but also stayed near me. Since the terrible night of the ants, Mother had been creeping her remorse in flat-footed circles around me without ever speaking of it, wearing her guilt like the swollen breasts of a nursing mother. So far, I had refused to suckle and give her relief, but I kept close by. I had no choice since she and Ruth May and I were thrown together by caste, set apart from Leah the Huntress. By choice, we also stayed far from Rachel and Father. Their noisy presences of two different kinds embarrassed us in this field of earnest, quiet work. Sometimes I set a hand above my eyes and looked for Leah, but did not see her. Instead, I watched Ruth May crunch thoughtfully on a caterpillar. Soiled and subdued, she looked like a small, malnourished relative of my previous sister. The faraway look of her eyes must have been the Muntu of Ruth May, chained to this briefly belligerent child through forelife, life, and afterlife, peering out through her sockets. The fire ran ahead at times and sometimes flagged as if growing tired like the rest of us. The heat was unspeakable. I imagined the taste of water. As the ring burned smaller, we suddenly caught sight of its other side, the red-orange tongues and black ash closing in. The looming shapes of animals bunched up inside. Antelopes, bushbucks, broad-headed warthogs with warthog children running behind them. A troop of baboons ran with arched tails flying as they zigzagged, not yet understanding their entrapment. Thousands of insects beat the air to a pulpy soup of animal panic. Birds hit the wall of fire and lit like bottle rockets. When it seemed there was no more air, no more hope, the animals began to run out through the fire into the open where spears and arrows waited. The antelopes did not leap gracefully as I imagined they would. They wheeled like spooked horses around the inside of the circle, then suddenly veered out as if by accident or blindness. Seeing their companion shot in the neck with arrows, they heeled in panic, sometimes turning back to the flames, but mostly running straight on, straight toward people and death. A small spotted antelope fell down very near me and presented me with the strange, singular gift of its death. I watched its heaving sides slowly come to rest, as if it had finally caught its breath. Dark blood leaked from its delicate black mouth onto the charred ground. For every animal struck down, there rose an equal and opposite cry of human jubilation. Our hungry wishbone cracked and ran slick with marrow. Women knelt with their knives to skin the meat even before the hooves stopped beating the ground in panic. Of the large animals who came through the fire, bushbuck, warthog, antelope, few escaped. Others would not come out, and so they burned, small flame-feathered birds, the churning insects, and a few female baboons who had managed against all odds to carry their pregnancies through the drought. With their bellies underslung with precious clinging babies, they loped behind the heavy-maned males who would try to save themselves, but on reaching the curtain of flame where the others passed through, they drew up short, crouched low, understanding no choice but to burn with their children. The curtain of heat divided the will to survive from survival itself. I could have fallen trembling on the ground, but stood and watched instead, watched Kilunga's children shout and dance each time they found the scorched, angular bodies of a mother baboon and baby seared together. On account of these deaths, Kilunga's gleeful children would live through another season. The Bantu, who watched from above, would have seen a black festival of life and death, indistinguishable one from the other, against the black scorched ground. As that day would turn out, my sister Rachel became, briefly, a vegetarian. My sisters Ruth May and Leah, forager and hunter. I became something else. On the day of the hunt, I came to know in the slick center of my bones this one thing. All animals kill to survive, and we are animals. The lion kills the baboon kills fat grasshoppers. The elephant tears up living trees, dragging their precious roots from the dirt they love. The hungry antelope shadow passes over the startled grass. And we, even if we had no meat or even grass to gnaw, still boil our water to kill the invisible creatures that would like to kill us first, and swallow quinine pills. The death of something living is the price of our own survival, and we pay it again and again. We have no choice. It is the one solemn promise every life on earth is born and bound to keep. Leah. I killed my first game, a beautiful, tawny beast with curved horns and a black diagonal stripe across his flanks, a young male impala. He was completely bewildered by the fire, too young to have any good strategy for danger, but old enough to need to put on a show. He ran pell-mell, snorting like a playground bully, till he was one of the last of his kind left inside the circle. I knew he'd soon come through. The way his hooves tore at the ground was so desperate, and his family already gone. I crouched near Nelson, watching. Nelson had taken down two bushbucks, one after the other, and signaled to me that he was going to claim his arrows. The impala he was leaving to me. I followed it with my eye, as Nelson had taught me to do, looking for the path of its hopes. Suddenly, I saw exactly where it would break through the fire. He would come straight toward me and veer to my right, where his mother had gone. Even a playground bully will want his mother in the bitter end. I held my breath to stop my arms from trembling. I had the hunger and thirst of a famine all to myself, smoke in my burning eyes, and no strength left. I prayed to Jesus to help me, then to any other God who would listen. Help me keep my left arm straight and my right pulled back and my arrow tight against the gut string, ready to sing and fly. One, he came and dodged. Two, he came closer. Three, he broke his gait, paused. Four, he leaped sideways away from me, all four legs drawn together in midair for half a second, and then he ran on. Only when I saw the spray of brown blood did I understand I'd hit him. My own heart plunged and burst against my ears. I have killed an animal larger than myself. I screamed as if struck by an arrow myself. Before I realized my legs had moved me, I was chasing the impala down the path of his hopes. The forest he could see at the end of the long, charred valley where he would find his mother and safety. But he crumpled, slowed, and fell down. I stood over him, breathing fast. It took me a minute to understand what I saw. Two arrows in his flank. Neither of them fletched red, as my arrows were. And Tata Ndu's oldest son, Gabinye, shouting at me to get away, go on away. Ah, Bucky! Meaning that I was a thief. But then Nelson was beside me, waving my arrow. This arrow killed that impala, he shouted at Gabinye. It passed through the neck. Look at yours, two little pricks in his flank. He never even felt them before he died. Gabinye's lip curled. How would a woman's arrow kill a yearling impala? By making a hole in his neck, Gabinye, your arrows went for the tail like a dog after his bitch. Where was your aim, Nkento? Gabinye raised his fist, and I was sure he would kill Nelson for that insult. But he flung his finger toward me instead and shook it as if he were ridding himself of blood or slime, commanded me to skin the impala and bring the meat down to the village, then turned and walked away from us. Nelson drew his knife and knelt to help me with the tedious work of cutting through the tendons and peeling back the pelt. I felt mixed up, grateful, and sick at heart. Nelson had ridiculed Gabinye's aim by calling him Nkento, a woman. Rachel. If you even think you can picture how awful it was, you are wrong. Lambs to the slaughter. We were, or the animals were, I don't even know who I feel sorry for the most. It was the most despicable day of my life. I stood on that burnt-up field with the taste of ashes in my mouth, ashes in my eyes, on my hair and my dress, all stained and tarnished. I stood and prayed to the Lord Jesus, if he was listening, to take me home to Georgia, where I could sit down in a White Castle and order a hamburger without having to see its eyes roll back in its head and the blood come spurting out of its corpse. Oh, they cheered to see it. I've not seen so much cheering since a homecoming game. Everybody jumped for joy. Me too, at first, for I was thinking, hooray, a half-decent meal at last. If I eat one more egg omelet, I think I'll turn over easy and cluck. But by the end of the day, everybody was smeared with blood like creepy, happy ghouls, and I couldn't bear to be one of them myself. Everything changed. The villagers transformed into brutish creatures before my very eyes, with their hungry mouths gaping wide. My own sister Leah got down on her knees and eagerly skinned a poor little antelope, starting out by slitting its belly and peeling back the skin over its back with horrible ripping sounds. She and Nelson hunkered down side by side, using a knife and even their teeth to do it. Both of them were so covered with ashes they looked like the pot and the kettle, each one blacker than the other. When they finished with the thing, it lay there limp on the ground, all shiny blue and red, covered with a slick white film. It looked like our old hound dog Babe, except all made of gristle and blood. Its bare dead eyes gaped out of its head, pleading for mercy. I bent over and threw up on my PF flyers. Lord Jesus, I couldn't help it. I went straight back down the burned-up hill and marched all the way home without even telling Mother I was leaving. I am 17 years old after all, not a child, and I alone will decide the fate of my life. The rest of them were all going to the stupid town square with the plan, I'm sure, being to whoop and holler about our good fortune and divide up all the dead loot. Not me. I latched myself up tight in our kitchen house, tore off my filthy clothes, and threw them into the stove. I heated the big kettle of water and poured it into the galvanized tub and sat in it like a scalded potato, alone in this world, just crying. Mother's picture of President Eisenhower looked down at me from the wall, and I crossed my arms over my naked chest for shame, crying even harder. I felt my red skin was going to scald plumb off, and then I'd look just like that poor antelope. They wouldn't be able to tell me from any other skinned carcass they drug home that day. Fine with me if I died right along with the rest of the poor animals. Who'd care anyway? When the water cooled down, I sat there looking up at the president. His round white head was so friendly and kind, I cried like a baby because I wanted him for a father instead of my own parents. I wanted to live under the safe protection of somebody who wore decent clothes, bought meat from the grocery store like the good Lord intended, and cared about others. I vowed that if I lived through this ordeal, I would not touch a single one of those animals they trapped and killed out there on the hillside like innocent children. That's all they were, the baboons and warthogs and antelopes scared crazy by the fire. And the people, no different from animals, Leah and all those men licking their lips, already tasting roasted meat in the smoke of the fire. And poor little Ruth May, picking up burnt grub worms and putting them straight in her mouth because her own parents can't keep her fed. All of them out there in the hot sun that day were just dumb animals cursed with the mark of ash on their brow. That's all. Poor, dumb animals running for their lives. Leah. It should have been the most glorious day in our village, but instead, it all came crashing down. 50 years from now, if I'm still living, I will look back on that one afternoon and the morning that followed. Even then, I swear I'll know it for what it was, the most terrible day of our lives. After the hunt ended, there was supposed to be a celebration, but before the old men could drag their drums out under the tree and get the dancing started, it had already turned into a melee of screaming and fighting. Men we had known as kindly, generous fathers suddenly became strangers with clenched fists and wide eyes shouting into each other's faces. Ruth May burst into tears and hid in Mother's skirt. I don't think she ever understood what happened. Not ever. I know I played a part. I do understand that. But so much had already gone wrong before I joined in. From the time we first set foot in Kalanga, things were going wrong, though we couldn't see it. Even the glorious independence was not going to be good for everyone, as they'd promised that day on the riverbank when Lumumba and the Belgians raised up their different promises and the White King lurked somewhere in disguise. There were going to be winners and losers. Now there are wars in the south, killings in the north, rumors that foreigners took over the army and want to murder Lumumba. On the day of the hunt, a war was already roaring towards us, whites against blacks. We were all swept up in a greediness we couldn't stop. My argument with Gabinye over the Impala, which really I killed, became a shouting match between people who'd voted for me and those who'd voted against. Some changed sides, mostly turning against me because of Tata Kuvadundu's warnings. The terrible things he promised were already starting to happen. Eyes watched us from the trees as we dragged our burden of meat down to the village, piled it up, and gathered around in a hungry knot. Gabinye was the first to move, pulling my antelope off the pile and holding it proudly in the air. Tata Ndu took it from him, raised his machete, and with one hard blow sliced off a hindquarter. This he picked up and threw toward me. It hit the ground with a thump in front of me, throwing blood on my socks. In the perfect absence of any human sound, the locusts and the leaves above us roared in my ears. I knew what I ought to do, pick it up in both hands and give it to Mama Mwanza. I should turn the other cheek. But the sin of pride took hold of me with a fierce grip. I picked up the whole bleeding leg and threw it at Gabinye, hitting him square across the back as he gloated to his friends. He staggered forward and one of his friends laughed. Tata Ndu turned to me, his eyes ferocious under his huge, furrowed brow. He flung his hand toward us in disgust. Tata Price has refused his family's share of meat, he announced in Kikongo. Abu Mpia, who's next? He glared at each silent face in turn. Anatole, he declared at last. Anatole Baana Bansisila Au Aana. Anatole the Orphan, without descendants. the bitterest insult that could be borne by a Congolese man. "For you, this will be plenty," pronounced Tata Ndu, pointing at the same skimpy hindquarter in the dirt. Only hours ago it had been the strong hind leg of an antelope boy. Now it lay naked at our feet, covered with filth. It looked more like a curse than a gift. Anatole answered in his polite schoolteacher's voice, "Excusez-moi, Tata Ndu, mais non. Ça c'est de quand a demi de la famille prise. La grande bête là, c'est la mienne." In his two hands, by himself, Anatole the orphan, without descendants, began to drag away one of the large bushbucks he'd shot on the hill. It wasn't right for Tata Ndu to insult Anatole, who hadn't really taken my side, but only argued for people to think for themselves. Now I was terrified that he'd be driven away from associating with our family at all. Tata Pawanda stepped forward to help Anatole, I saw with relief, but then Tata Pawanda pulled away abruptly and began to shout, and I understood he was claiming Anatole's bushbuck for himself. The elder, Mama Bawanda, ran forward screaming and struck Anatole in the face. He let go, stumbling backward. I ran to steady him, but was rammed from behind by old one-armed Tata Kili, who could not get past me fast enough in his hurry to claim his own stake. Behind him came the two Mama Kilis, determined to oversee his claim and raise it. Tata Ndu spoke again, but was drowned out by the wave of our neighbors that rolled forward, parting and closing around him. And so it came to pass that the normal happy event of dividing food after a hunt became a war of insults and rage and starving bellies. There should have been more than enough for every family, but as we circled to receive our share of providence, the fat flanks of the magnificent beasts we'd stalked on the hill shrank to parched sinew, the gristle of drought-starved carcasses. Abundance disappeared before our eyes. Where there was plenty, we suddenly saw not enough. Even little children slapped their friends and stole caterpillars from each other's baskets. Sons shouted at their fathers. Women declared elections and voted against their husbands. The elderly men, whose voices hardly rose above a whisper because they were so used to being listened to, were silenced completely in the ruckus. Tata Kuvadundu looked bedraggled and angry. His white robe was utterly blackened with ash. He raised his hands and once again swore his prophecy that the animals and all of nature were rising up against us. We tried to ignore his strange remarks, but we all did hear him. In some corner of our hearts, we all drew back, knowing he was right. The dead beasts in our hands seemed to be cursing and mocking us for having killed them. In the end, we all crept home with our meat, feeling hunted ourselves. What was surely the oldest celebration of all, the sharing of plenty, had fallen to ruin in our hands. Rachel. By nightfall, my sisters and parents came home, and everything had gone crazy. Nothing went the way I expected. I'd gotten out of my bath, dressed in clean clothes, towel-dried my hair, and was sitting quietly in the front room, prepared to announce to my family that I was a vegetarian. I understood full well what this meant. From now on, I would have to exist on bananas and have poor nutrition. I knew Mother would have strong opinions about where I'd wind up, with curved legs and weak bones like the poor Congolese children. But I shan't care, not even if my hair falls out. At 17, I have my rights, and besides, I'd made my own secret plan. As soon as Eben Axelrod came back, I was determined to use my feminine wiles to my own advantage. No matter what it took, I would get him to take me away from here in his airplane. "My fiancé, Mr. Axelrod, and I are planning on returning to America," I would tell them, "where it's a free country and you can get anything to eat that you want." But this is not the conversation that happened. When they came home, everybody was having a conniption about a big giant fight in the village over who got whose share of their horrid meat. They went on talking and remarking about it while Mother built a fire in the stove and put in their antelope leg to roast and mash some plantains. It did smell so good. You could hear it all sizzling and crispy and juicy. And I have to confess, when dinner time came, I did eat a few small bites, but only because I was positively weak with hunger. And I got to thinking about my hair falling out. But if there had been a grocery store within 100 miles, believe me, I would have walked there on my own reconnaissance for some cuisine that didn't still have feet attached to it. At dinner, the ruckus of our household was still going on, with Leah still saying over and over how she shot a whole antelope herself and it was not fair that our family didn't get it. Father informed her that God showed no mercy upon those who flouted their elders and that he, Reverend Price, had washed his hands of her moral education. He said this in just the plainest everyday voice, as if discussing that the dog had gotten into the garbage again. He stated that Leah was a shameful and inadequate vessel for God's will, and that was why he would no longer even stoop to punishing her when she needed it. Leah spoke back to him in a calm voice as if she too were discussing whatever had gotten into the garbage, and it certainly wasn't her. She said, "Is that your point of view, Father? How interesting that you think so," and so forth. Which was fine and dandy for her, I guess, if she wasn't going to get punished for it. Lucky duck.